It's about the carer having the confidence to ask the doctor or the nurse to step outside the curtain or to step outside the door, you know, and just say, look, I'm really worried. This is new. We've never been this sick before. We've never dealt with anything like this before. And then for that person, the medical professional, to actually take a moment to listen to what's being said.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast. My name is Fergal Fox and today we're talking about sepsis in an effort to raise awareness of this common cause of death and illness. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with us about the podcast or join our mailing list, please send us an email at healthandwellbeing.communications@hse.ie. Now, we have some very important information for you today about sepsis. This could help you ask the key question when dealing with an infection: could this be sepsis? This information could be life-saving for you, a loved one, or someone in your care. Research has shown that there's a relatively high level of awareness of sepsis with the public, but there isn't good awareness of the signs and symptoms. Our guests today both have intimate knowledge of sepsis. Sadly, Aisling O'Rourke's father passed away in 2020, and Dr. Michael O'Dwyer is the clinical lead of the HSE sepsis program, and they've joined me today. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Michael, I might start with you and just explain to our listeners again what sepsis is. Some people will have an awareness of it, of the word, but what is it? What do we need to know?
Sure thing, Fergal. Well, first of all, it's as you say, a life-threatening illness. It's time-dependent in that the earlier that you get treatment, the better your chances of survival are. And then what is it? It always starts with an infection. And then what happens is that the body's response that would normally control and eliminate that infection through the immune system becomes dysregulated and enters this vicious cycle where it gets amplified and begins to attack the body's own organs, then leading to organ failure and signs and symptoms that might be very distant from where the infection started.
So it's always a secondary thing. Is that fair?
Yeah, it always starts with an infection. So examples maybe are the best way to have a think about how it progresses. And maybe the easiest example would be a cut on the finger, something like that. And these infections, I think it's important to also say that the vast majority of them get better by themselves or maybe with some antibiotics. If you take the example of a cut on your finger, it might get sore, it might get red, and that's the immune system trying to clean up the infection. And then in the case of sepsis, it begins to spread. And in that specific example, you might see like red lines streaking up your arm. You might start to feel some lymph nodes in under your arm. But then as the immune system becomes body-wide, you might notice some symptoms that have got nothing to do with your finger. So you might start to feel short of breath as your lungs get affected. You might notice that you haven't peed for 12 or 24 hours as your kidneys begin to fail. You might get dizzy when you stand up. You might see some skin changes as your blood pressure falls. And they're all signs that that infection really has left the finger and sepsis has started. And now there's this whole body response. And that'll lead then eventually to organ failure and death if not treated. But that infection can be anywhere. It doesn't have to be the finger. It can start as a urinary tract infection and then spread body-wide. It can start and probably most commonly starts as a pneumonia or a chest infection and then spreads body-wide after that. But that infection always precedes sepsis. And that infection doesn't have to be bacterial. It can be viral, it can also be fungal or parasitic, but it's actually reasonably common to be viral as well. And so what we've seen over the last couple of years, particularly with COVID, has been a global pandemic of what really was sepsis and a sepsis syndrome.
So it's quite common. I was surprised how common it is that we have, like, how many cases would we have in Ireland on an annual basis?
So we record the cases and the numbers we record are about 15,000 cases of sepsis a year. And we underestimate these quite a lot by the nature of the way we collect these data from the hospitals. So it's data from the HIPE system in the public hospitals. So we don't collect data from the private hospitals. And it's also very dependent on how the clinicians within the hospitals code and record the signs and symptoms that we're seeing. So we record 15,000 cases, but it's far in excess of that, I think.
And we're doing this, this is part of an awareness campaign around sepsis. I suppose the HSE is aware that we need to let people know more about the signs and symptoms. That's why you're here, Aisling. I'm very sorry to hear about your dad, but tell us about him.
So my dad, John O'Rourke, we'd been caring for him since 2018. He had a rare disease, AL amyloidosis. So by the time we got to November 2020, his care had been directed by the research facility at the Royal Free Hospital in London. That was all through the HSC's treatment abroad scheme. And he was in remission from that at the time. But with amyloidosis, it forms a plaque on organs around the body. And in Dad's case, it had attacked his heart. So he was, even though he was in remission from the amyloidosis at the time because of the treatment, he was in end stage heart failure. So he was very weak. So on November 13th, he, with all the different treatments and hospital appointments, one of the things he had to do regularly was get a B12 shot. And he woke up that morning, just didn't quite feel well, had been in for treatment that week, thought maybe it was kind of a hangover from that, maybe just a bit more tired than usual. But when he was going into the GP, my mum wasn't allowed in with him because it was COVID. So he had to go in on his own and said to the GP, I don't feel very well. The GP checked his temperature and said, look, you know, go home and rest. And that was kind of it. Didn't really think more of that. But as he progressed through the afternoon, just he began to get weaker. Wasn't really as chatty as normal. You know, there was just clearly something not quite right. It was a Friday and my mum and I were very conscious of the fact that, you know, if we left it go too late in the day, his team would be gone home for the weekend. So she made a phone call to his team. They said, get him straight into A&D. So I arrived in the door and mum was trying to physically lift him out of the chair to get him into the car. And that was very unusual. Like my dad, even though he'd been very, very unwell, he was still very mobile. And the idea that he needed help to even get out of a chair was just a shock for me to see. So 5 o'clock the Friday evening, I drove him into A&D. We needed the help of two porters to get him out of my car into a wheelchair to get him in the door of the hospital, which again was very unusual. As luck would have it, treated by a young Portuguese doctor who was a bit of a fan of sport, so they could chat about golf and rugby. And nicely enough, this gentleman kept, there was a rugby match on that night and he kept Dad up to date with the score throughout the evening. So he had said at the time that, look, we're going to have to keep you in overnight. I need to do some tests. And we'd accepted that. Because of his situation, he was in an isolation room. So my mum was allowed in with him to stay with him for the evening. My father had had a number of strokes as a result of the amyloidosis and he had vascular dementia. So his short-term memory could be quite challenged at times. So it was always very important for one of us to be with him at an appointment because he wouldn't always remember what he needed to ask the doctors, or he wouldn't always remember what a doctor had said to him. So we had to be with him so that we knew how to care for him because he wouldn't remember the information himself. So at about 10 o'clock that evening, the junior doctor came in and said, look, I've been told I have to send him home. It's a minor infection. What we didn't know was that he had gone through sepsis protocol and ordered the tests. So he had done the chest x-ray, he'd sent off the blood sample, the urine sample and all of that. But unfortunately, he didn't communicate that to us. And the doctor who he reported to, who then reported to another doctor, what we've discovered since then is that the message of how physically immobile my father was as a result of being so sick on that evening, it just didn't pass through the chain of conversation. So he came home at 10 o'clock. We weren't worried because we were told minor infection, don't worry about it. Anybody listening to this who has cared for a family member will know that being a carer means you're in and out of A&E. So when they tell you that it's nothing to worry about, you don't worry about it. So he watched the rugby. He was able to watch it back on the player, went to bed about midnight. We all went to bed, didn't check in on him overnight because again, it was just a minor infection. The landline rang at 7:30 on the Saturday morning. The fact that the landline rang at all is unusual nowadays, but 7:30 on a Saturday morning was particularly unusual. So we were told then that the lab had found an infection in his blood. Now, the word sepsis wasn't used, just an infection in his blood, and that he should have been on a drip overnight and we needed to get him into A&E as quickly as we could. The challenge was that in the system that we have, the hospital couldn't order an ambulance for us. We then had to make the phone call to order an ambulance or to request an ambulance. The person on the phone didn't quite understand when I said we can't get him out of bed to get him into hospital. They sent a paramedic in a car, not in an ambulance. So between the jigs and the reels, we ended up with three paramedics because the senior paramedic that arrived in the car had to get the ambulance when he arrived and saw how serious the situation was. Dad was communicating with us, but he was kind of in and out of consciousness. And
when he wasn't able to move himself out of the bed, he was a 6'4" man, I knew I physically wasn't going to be able to get him out. So they did some tests. And like, I think paramedics, when we talk about healthcare workers, are often forgotten about in our society. Like, I can't praise them highly enough. On that occasion, or any occasion we had to call them to the house for Dad, they just treated us with such dignity and him with such dignity. So they went through all their tests, and the senior person on duty in that scenario in the morning said, "Aisling, I'm now informing you that I'm starting sepsis protocol because I suspect sepsis."
Right.
And I just felt sick.
Because that word was hitting alarm bells with you.
I didn't know what it meant, really. I didn't know the symptoms.
Yeah.
I knew then, I didn't know how many people survive sepsis then. To me, sepsis was death.
Right.
I knew that we were going to lose him that day. So they had to get him out and into the ambulance. And so that phone call came at 7:30 on the Saturday morning. It wasn't until 10 o'clock that morning that they were driving out our driveway. Between waiting for them to arrive, the paramedics having to go through their own protocols, physically getting him out of bed and into the ambulance, it all took time. So there was a 12-hour gap there between him being discharged from A&E and him getting back into A&E, where he could have been receiving treatment. Now, as I said, and it's why I said at the beginning, my dad was in end-stage heart failure, and sepsis in that scenario more than likely wasn't going to bring good news. But my thing is, we didn't know to ask in the hospital that night, could it be sepsis? We didn't know to...
Well, that's the key question. We're, you know, the HSE is encouraging us now to ask ourselves, bring this awareness of the things we're going to be talking about today. And the case with your father is it's really sad. But I suppose you're here today as an advocate trying to get behind the sepsis campaign and raise awareness of all these things.
Yeah, like my dad died at 2 p.m. that afternoon.
Yeah.
It was in the blink of an eye and he was gone. My dad worked as an inspector in the Department of Agriculture. He did his 40-year service as a public servant. He believed passionately in public service. And after my mum and I got over the initial shock of what happened, we had a decision to make as to how we would proceed. And we felt the best way to do that would be to try and raise awareness. Because we wanted his death not to be in vain. We wanted somebody to know the signs and symptoms. Someone to just to know to ask.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with sepsis, because as Michael has outlined, sometimes the symptoms can be quite complex. And in that moment of panic, when you see a loved one being unwell, it can be really hard to remember the list of things.
Yeah.
But I think it's just to know to ask, could this be sepsis? Because when you ask the question, it triggers the protocol, you know, and it's another way of advocating for the person.
And full disclosure here, and it's nothing to do, it's just by coincidence, but I know your mother actually used to work just down the hall from me. And we used to go over to the canteen in Tullamore Hospital together sometimes for lunch. Mm. So both you and your mother were caring for your dad for a while before this happened.
Both of us are very independent women. Yeah. And neither one of us wanted to give up our jobs. So I had been, in 2018, I had been living in Dublin for quite some time. And when he got sick, to see, initially when Dad got sick, we were told that if he survived the weekend, it'd be very lucky. So I just moved home. There was like, I just, you know, whatever time we had, and I commuted up and down to Dublin for the couple of years that we were minding him, and we shared it between us. So I would do, mum was an early riser, I'm not. So she did the mornings, I did the evenings, and we managed in the daytimes then. And we were very lucky in that both of us had very understanding employers at the time. And it was very handy that mum worked in the same hospital as well as he was being treated in. So we got great support. And in particular, the team in London were phenomenal to deal with. Like, absolutely phenomenal to deal with. And like, the culture was completely different. Like, the very first appointment in London, the consultant said, "Oh, by the way, here's my mobile phone number. Any questions?" And I was kind of shocked. But yeah, it was just, we were very lucky. And like, the team in the Scott building in Tullamore really rallied around mum at that time and like supported her in whatever she needed, you know.
That's good. Yeah, she used to give me an odd update on how things were going. And, you know, she used to tell me about you as well, actually, which any good mother would, fair play to her. Yeah, so it's just by coincidence then that you know, you're turning up today as part of this campaign. But I might switch back to you, Michael, in terms of the symptoms, you know, because this seems to be a factor that we really want to emphasize today. Let's talk about the signs and symptoms for adults, first of all, that, you know, that we need to look out for is kind of, you know, if somebody has an infection, what are we looking out? What are the danger signs?
It can be really difficult to spot. It's difficult to spot and diagnose properly in the hospital with all of the diagnostics and tests available to you. It's really difficult to spot at home as well. But there are a couple of cardinal signs. You know, within that adult population, it's worth, I suppose, bearing in mind who's at the most risk as well. And the elderly are definitely at the most risk. And we've got maybe 60 to 70% of the cases are in patients age 65 and above. And the vast, vast majority of patients who develop sepsis have some coexistent other diseases as well. And it's all related to the immune system in particular. As you get older, your immune system doesn't work as well. That makes you more liable to develop infections. And then for sepsis to develop from that. And then if you have illnesses that affect your immune system as well, that puts you at heightened risk. And if you're at medications, if you're taking medications that dampen down your immune system, like chemotherapy or biologic agents or steroids or things like that, those are the types of patients that are at risk. So then within that adult population, I mean, you can take sepsis as a mnemonic and take your signs from that. If you take that first S, we put that down as slurred speech or confusion. And within the older cohort, that might be the only thing you'll see. It'll be completely unrelated to where the infection started. So it could start, for example, like in the urinary tract, but that patient will present to someone who's confused or the slurred speech. And like Aisling said, you know, carers are very much in tune as to what the people they're looking after are like.
Yeah.
And I hear that he's just not himself. And that's what we hear. And that comes into that confusion type symptom. The E, we would say, is extreme pain, extreme shivering, extreme muscle aches, things like that can be a sign of it. Another S for shortness of breath. So people who are breathing very fast would be a sign of it. The P is for pee or producing urine. So if you haven't produced any urine for 24 hours or more, that's a sign that your kidneys are starting to be affected. And we hear that from lots and lots of people. They're saying, well, it was really noticeable that I was like maybe drinking lots of water because I wasn't feeling so well, but I just wasn't peeing. And the I is for survivors of sepsis would come back to us and say that they felt unlike anything they felt before in their life. And I felt like I was going to die would be a very common thing that's fed back to us from survivors. And then the final S would be for skin changes, for mottled skin. Could be cold or blue, or could be very, the rashes are very common in sepsis as well. And there was that very common rash with meningococcal disease that we don't see so much anymore, but a rash that doesn't fade when you press on it with a glass tumbler. But those symptoms are really wide. And again, it's the persistence of the symptoms, somebody who's just not getting better and somebody who's not themselves. And like I say, carers are very in tune with the people they're looking after and what's normal for them.
So we mentioned over 65s are particularly at risk here, people that have already something going on for them in terms of chronic disease or some vulnerability. And Aisling, I know one of your key messages is to carers, because, you know, the role yourself and your mother were playing is caring for your dad. You knew what was normal.
I think, like, with the greatest respect to the medical professional, the person who's caring for the patient at home, they know them better than anybody else. Like, even the patient themselves will know their body better than anybody else. And it is so important to have the confidence to be able to say to the doctor, the nurse, the person at the door, or even the 999 operator, that I know this person, I care for them 24/7. And these symptoms are not normal. This is very unusual. I heard your episode where you interviewed Bernard Loster. And he spoke about the traditional paternalistic attitude in the health service that he and his, like all of you, are working to get rid of. But that is still there a little bit, you know, where, oh, I'm the doctor, I know best. And the thing about it is the doctor doesn't always know best because you're not living with the patient. And while you might be an expert in the area, there is an element of trust where if a carer says to you, this is very unusual, I'm very worried, I've seen this person be ill before, but this is worse, they're not being dramatic or paranoid. They're sharing that with you because it is very severe. And it's about the carer having the confidence to actually say that, look, I'm genuinely worried here. And even if that means you ask the doctor or the nurse to step outside the curtain or to step outside the door, you know, and just say, look, I'm really worried. This is new. we've never been this sick before, we've never dealt with anything like this before. And then for that person, the medical professional, to actually take a moment to listen to what's being said. I think sometimes in the chaos of the emergency department environment, that can be very challenging because, you know, the medical professionals are dealing with so many people in, yeah. in such a chaotic environment. It's so important to actually, if someone says to you, I'm their carer, this is not right, this is not normal, I'm very worried, to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's very, very good. And it reminds me of the symptoms that you were describing, Michael, because it does sound like, you know, these are serious symptoms. You're the person that you're caring or that you're minding is going deeper into some, you know, illness.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And we've tried to formalize that in some way, the charts that we use for the patient observations to try and identify the cohort of deteriorating patients has a section in it for family and carer concerns, so that gets formally adopted and there's an objective score put to that. And we try and push that as well, that you can't ignore the people who know the patients best when they tell you that something's not right, because the symptoms are insidious. It's not like a heart attack or a stroke where it's a very clear, I've got some chest pain, or stroke symptoms can be very obvious. The symptoms are very widespread and can be missed really easily. And it's the people who know the patients best know that something's going wrong.
So we keep coming back to that question. We need to ask ourselves, could this be sepsis? But then what are the signs for children? Are they any different?
Yeah, with the disease process is very much the same. It's just that children, I suppose, complain differently, if you
right,
like, or
yeah,
you might
yeah.
notice different things within them. So again, the very young children, the confusion that you might see in an adult patient in a child might manifest as a child who's abnormally sleepy, won't get out of bed, you know, won't wake up, won't feed, won't interact like that. The urinary symptoms are again the same, but you'll notice it in terms of wet nappies. So you've changed the nappy, but it hasn't been wet for maybe a day or so, and you're wondering what's happening. Vomiting and persistent vomiting is a sign, and that very rapid breathing is a sign in children as well. And it's in children, and again, it's the other side of the immune system. In those very young children, the immune system hasn't developed properly, and that's what puts them at risk, the very young children, of developing sepsis.
So this awareness campaign, like this information is needed by everybody. What do you think the level of awareness is out there? Ashton, you thought, you know, it was triggering a word for you, but you said you weren't aware of the symptoms.
No, and I think there's a misconception that you have to have a cut or you have to have had surgery, that there has to be kind of a wound to get sepsis. I think that's something
traditionally I would have seen it as blood poisoning.
Yes.
I thought that was the word that was, but so I thought there had to be some damage.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Whereas any infection at all, like, and what we believe happened in Dad's case was he had a catheter. So as far as we can't be 100% certain, but we believe it was a urinary tract infection that kicked it all off. So that any infection, like a chest infection, you know, like I actually have a friend, a very good friend, who's now had sepsis 6 times.
Right.
And has started as a chest infection most recently, you know. So it's that awareness, I think, of trusting your gut. And I think that's the really important thing, that if you really, really don't feel well, you have to treat that in the same way as you would a stroke or a heart attack. Like, don't be afraid of calling 999. Like, as Irish people, we have this terrible habit of never wanting to cause a fuss.
Yeah.
And sure, oh God, sure, they're so busy in the hospital, you know.
I'd be grand.
Yeah, I'd be fine. I'm just having a bad night. I'll be fine in the morning. Like, more people die of sepsis in Ireland than do heart and stroke.
Really?
So, like, we have to take it really seriously. And I think, like, in our case, the junior doctor that was caring for Dad was overruled. You know, he ordered the sepsis tests. We can see it, and we can see it in his notes that he suspected sepsis. But between the long and the short of it, either there was a lack of confidence in portraying the message, or there was a lack of trust. Somehow the communication piece wasn't heard there.
Yeah.
So he was discharged. So I think from everybody, from a carer, from a patient and the member of staff that's looking at, whether it's a paramedic, a nurse, a doctor, a porter, if someone really feels, do you know what, there's something really wrong here, we all need to have the confidence to speak up and ask, could it be sepsis?
Yeah, that's the key question we keep coming back to, that kind of deep lethargy, or that you're talking about somebody really feeling Like there's something wrong. This is different, isn't that it, Michael?
Yeah, that it's different. And I mean, you talk about blood poisoning, you know, then maybe the colloquial name has changed through the years. And blood poisoning is a feature. And I think what's meant by that is just the presence of bacteria within the blood. But right. Those bacteria don't have to come from a cut. They can absolutely come from urinary tract infection. They can come from a pneumonia. And those would be the two most common sources of them. And then reading between the lines, like you have to suspect it, but then our tests within the hospital are so imperfect. The gold standard test is a blood culture. So we'll take blood from the patient and we'll try and grow the bacteria from that. But that test takes probably 24 hours at least before you get a positive result. And in about half the patients that we're absolutely sure have sepsis, that test is negative. So it sounds like what happened in Aisling's case is that test was taken when her dad went to hospital, but it took that 24 hours for it to flag up as positive. And then that's what you might refer to as blood poisoning in the past. So they found bacteria within his bloodstream and decided then that he needs to come back because he must have been on oral antibiotics. So he's on.
He was sent home with Augmentin at 10 o'clock and the blood culture came back at about 7, and that's when the phone call then was issued. So like, the people who saw him on the night, as far as we know him and we've discussed it with the hospital concerned, they followed the protocol. And it was that culture that came back, that infection, as it was put to us on the phone, an infection was found in the blood. So it is. And I think that's the thing. Like, my dad was only 67 when he died. He was very lucky in that he was a very fit and active man before he was became sick in 2018. He was doing very well in the scheme of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So for him to die that rapidly was not anticipated. You know, it was so rapid. Like he got up in the morning, went to the GP at 11, didn't feel great, but not seriously ill. By about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, my mum became very worried about him, into A&E at 5, discharged at 10, back in at 10, and died at 2. Like, there wasn't even 24 hours
there.
Yeah, yeah. It was
scary,
so rapid.
It really is.
And that's pretty typical. I mean, we see that all the time. The speed with which it develops is pretty frightening. And I think another important point there is that Aisling's dad went home on antibiotics. And it can develop and progress even if you are on antibiotics. And so that message needs to get across as well. And from us to the hospitals to tell the patients and GPs and pharmacies that you've come in, you've had an infection, and it's been deemed that you need some antibiotics by tablet to make that better. But that doesn't mean that it's definitely not going to progress from there. And so, again, there's a, not to panic people, you know, those tablets will almost always take care of the infection, but there should be a set of signs and symptoms to look out for. And if you're not getting better on those tablets within 24, 48 hours, you still can't get up off the couch, you're not doing what you'd normally do, then you need to come back in and be seen again.
Okay. So tell us more about what's happening in the health service to, you know, to get these messages across or to raise awareness and kind of get everybody working in the health service asking the question, could this be sepsis?
So the program started in 2014, the National Sepsis Program, and it started as a result of a tragic death in Galway, a maternal sepsis death. And so from that, the program was born. And really the primary focus of the program for the first 6-7 years after it was formed was to promote education and awareness within the hospitals. So to get the staff up to speed with what to look out for, how to diagnose, what the most up-to-date treatment protocols were, and to try and streamline that treatment so that patients coming in the door were recognized quickly that it was suspected. They were recognized quickly and that a treatment protocol followed. So we have sepsis nurses throughout the country, one associated with each hospital group. And they're there, you know, every day during the week, spreading that message, providing education, and also collecting data that feed back to give us some results as to how prevalent this is and how the treatment pathways are working. You know, we've developed a couple of online training programs for junior doctors, for nurses. They're in place through all the hospitals throughout the country. And again, it's just getting that message out there as something to suspect, because we all know that the earlier you treat this when it develops, the better better your chances of survival are.
Okay, so before we finish the episode, where should we send people that want more information on this? You know, where's the key signpost here in terms of, you know, people reading up and becoming really familiar with these symptoms? They have them in their back pocket, or they want to search them when they have that concern, because that's the case, isn't it? You know, sometimes we need to go back to the internet when these questions kind of come up for us.
So the HSE website, hse.ie/sepsis, there's more information on signs and symptoms and what to look out for.
Okay. So look, I'd like to thank both of you for coming in today. I think it's a very important topic, and I think you're doing good work. I really appreciate your support of the campaign, Aisling.
No problem.
And for the listeners, we'd ask that you share this episode with a colleague or friend who you may think might benefit or be interested in this topic. Maybe pass it on in one of your WhatsApp groups. Our listeners will appreciate the need to spread the word for things like sepsis. And you can also keep up to date with us on social media by following #TalkingHealthAndWellbeing. And thanks for tuning in to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast. Mm-hmm.